trying to cover Kol HaTorah Kula in an hour and 40 minutes, or certainly a nice chunk of different topics. We have the general topic today is Sidur HaDin, which has to do with just the basic process of the administration of justice in a Din Torah proceeding in front of a Beit Din, which contains many different components. The first 25 simanim or so of Shulchan Aruch, first 28 simanim of Shulchan Aruch deal with halachos pertaining to Sidur HaDin, halachos pertaining to Dayanim, how judges are supposed to conduct the Din Torah process in all of its elements, from the very beginning of when a Din Torah is initiated until the actual course of the proceedings of a Din Torah, how they're conducted, and then the issuance of a psak, of a decision, what to do if a psak is issued incorrectly. So the roughly the first 26 simanim or so have to do with these inyanim, then it's followed by hilchos edus, laws relating to witnesses and testimony, and then there's halachos of tohen v'nitzon, of evidence, evidentiary rules. But the first chunk of simanim hilchos shemishpat are devoted really to Sidur HaDin. It's a very nice sefer on Sidur HaDin that covers many of the elements and components of the process. It was written by Rav Eli of Shochetman. It's called Sidur HaDin. A scholar, a Jewish law scholar, Talmud Chacham in Eretz Yisrael, which I highly recommend. And there are a number of other sources. The basic sources, obviously, are those Simanim and Shulchan Aruch, Torah Shulchan Aruch, and the related Meforshim. And we're going to cover some of the basic issues today relating to some of these topics of Sidur HaDin. My position, at least over the last 10 years or so, has been as the Menahel of the Beis Din of America, and in that capacity as the Menahel, the director of the Beis Din of America, it's been my job to supervise and coordinate Din Torah matters, Dinei Torah, arbitration matters, court proceedings in the Beis Din when two people have a dispute and they bring the dispute for the adjudication of a Beis Din. So the first part of the process is what we call Hazmana L'Din. That one person summons the other person, moving summons Shimon to come to a Din Torah. So it used to be that you would actually have a Shliach Beis Din. A Shliach Beis Din would come and would knock on Shimon's door. If Shimon wasn't there, would leave a summons, a word of a summons with a neighbor that Shimon is being summoned to come to Beis Din. If Shimon was supposed to agree to come to Beis Din, so that the dispute between Reuven and Shimon would be able to be heard in later years, when it became a little bit more impractical, you have thousands and thousands sometimes of Dinei Torah, especially in Eretz Yisrael, it became impractical to expect the Shliach to knock on the door every single time that a person needs to be summoned. So since we have, Baruch Hashem, a good mail system, a good post office system, it became more the practice that summonses would be sent through the mail. And a party is expected to answer summons that they received through the mail. So there are a couple of Gemaras that deal with the summons process. How a person is supposed to react, behave when they receive a summons, how much time you give somebody, how many opportunities you give somebody when they receive a summons. One Gemara that I put in the Mara Mekomis is on Bava Kama, Kuf Yud Gimel, Amud Aleph. The Gemara there simply says, Amar Chista, Kovin, this is on page one of the handout. Does everybody have a handout? If everybody has a handout, so I can feel comfortable reading from a handout, people will be able to follow, or they prefer that I not read it all from the handout. I can read? Okay. So, Amar Chista, Kovim Zman Sheni V'Chamishi V'Sheni. Chista says that if you establish times for a person to come to the Beis Din, if they don't come on Monday, so the Beis Din used to sit only on Mondays and Thursdays. So you say, if they can't come on Monday, they'll come on Thursday. If not on Thursday, they'll come the following Monday. Zimna V'Zimna Basa Zimna. Three times. L'macha Katzvinan. And then the following day, you write. What do you write? So this is in a case where a person refuses to come to Beis Din, you write what's known as a pesicha. What's a pesicha? A pesicha is a siruv. Pesicha is like a shamta. It's a contempt order which would be issued against somebody for failure to appear before the Beis Din. So this is the siruv process, and we have the same process nowadays as well. If a person is summoned to come before Beis Din, they refuse to come to Beis Din, then they are held to be in contempt. They can be subject to all kinds of ostracization methods of as a result of their contempt to come to Bezdin, excluded from the activity and of the community, not permitted to have aliyot, to be called up to the Torah, they're not invited to social events, not given a positions of kavod, of honor in the shul. So these are all consequences of a person being subject to a contempt order, but the main purpose of a contempt order is that a person should know that they have an obligation to come to a bezdin, and therefore, in order to avoid receiving the contempt order and to dispel having received the contempt order if they received one, the main motivation is that a person should be motivated to come to bezdin in order to not have the specter of contempt hovering over them. Now, says the Gemara, sometimes a contempt order can be issued much more quickly. He found a woman who was summoned to come to Bezdin in the morning. And without waiting Monday, Thursday, Monday, in the afternoon, they had already issued a contempt order against this woman. So he asked the question, Rav Asi asked Rav Kahana, in your community, why did you issue a seir so quickly? I thought that we're supposed to wait three times, give a person three opportunities. So Amini Gava. So he said, that's a man, not that we're discriminating between men and women, Chas V'Shalom, but just that the circumstances are such that in the socioeconomic conditions were that a man would travel on business quite a bit, and therefore maybe he wouldn't be there the first time, but he would be expected to be back by the second time. But a woman generally would not travel too far outside of her house. So Gava, Hanimili Gava, done is lazy Masa, a man is not necessarily always in the city, but this is like him from Masa asking Maregesi. But since she was there in the city and she knew that she was being summoned and she didn't show up, so she's immediately labeled as rebellious. So technically speaking, you don't even need to wait three times, it seems, before issuing a seiru. Nonetheless, they practice, and what is the reason for that? The reason for that is, why do you send out a hazmana or summons three different times? It's not to give people the opportunity to procrastinate and delay. The reason why a summons is sent out three times, explain the Mefarshim, and based on the Gemara, is because sometimes the person simply wasn't there the first time around. The Aruch HaShulchan, which I didn't put in the materials, goes further to explain, the beginning of Siman Yonav, Chosh Mishpah, goes further to explain that sometimes people are busy with all kinds of business affairs, they have a busy calendar, busy schedules, whatever it is, they can't necessarily be expected to be available the first time that they're called. So therefore, you give them a little bit of leeway, you give them some forbearance, you give them some extensions. You can give them extensions up until three times, but if it's clear that a person has what we call akirusa de bedina, that a person is insolent and is rebellious and rejects the authority of the Bezdin in a blatant fashion. They respond to the first hazmana by insulting the Shliach Bezdin or by saying, I don't believe in Bezdin or I'm not going to come to Bezdin. So then, technically speaking, a seir could be issued at an early appointed time. There's another Gemara, not in the materials, in Moed Katan, on Daf Tes Zayin Amud Aleph, that also gives even earlier sources of the notion of summoning to Bezdin from the story of Moshe and Korach in the Torah, where the Gemara says, "Amar Ravim, you know, in the Mashadrin and Shliach of the Beidin and Mizamnin Leivadina." How do we know that we send a Shliach Bezdin? As I said, now we use the male as a Shliach Bezdin, and we summon somebody to come to a din Torah. So we know from Dasan Varvim by the Ksi by Shlach Moshe. Moshe sent out to call a Dasan Varvim that they should come to a that they should come to a. That they should come and meet with him regarding their dispute. And how do we know that you issue a formal hazmana? Right, you and your entire people have to appear before HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Kamei Gavur Rabba, and you have to say who the Bezdin is that's summoning. Right, how do we know? You have to mention the name of the Bezdin. You could have many different batei din. We have in our community not one single Bezdin. As we're going to discuss, we have many different Bati Din. So you have to mention the source of the person who's Mazmin. In this case, he had a very exalted source, the Ksiv L'Pnei Hashem. In that case, it was to appear before Hashem. And atu palnia, how do you know? You have to mention who the other person is in the dispute, meaning that you have to say you're being summoned to the Bezdin, that you say to Shimon, you're being summoned to the Bezdin, but you're being summoned to the Bezdin by Reuven, right? How do you know you have to say by Reuven? Because the Torah says you have to come, your Eder has to come, and Aaron has to come. Aaron was the other part of the dispute, because Korach was disputing the authority of... Korach was disputing the authority of Aaron. The Kabin and Zimna, how do we know that we establish a time for the parties to come? The Ksim Machar, because it says you have to appear tomorrow, right? Moshe says to Korach and his Eder, you have to appear tomorrow. Now, in fact, based on this practice, many Batei Din, when they summon somebody to a Bez Din, they'll say appear tomorrow or appear next Wednesday at 10 in the morning in front of our Bez Din. This really makes the most sense when it's clear that that Bez Din is the only Bez Din in town and the parties have no option but to appear before that Bez Din. We recognize that parties, and we'll get into this, the parties don't necessarily have to appear before a specific Bez Din if there isn't a pre-agreed upon stipulation by the parties to come before that Bez Din, and therefore instead of saying you have to show up on such and such time, what our hazmanos, what our summonses typically say is you must respond to us by such and such date in order to tell us what it is that you plan to do, whether you plan to appear before our Bez Din, whether you plan to go before a different Bez Din, but you must at least register your response as to what you're prepared to do by a specific date, and we give that specific date. Finally, says the Gemara, Zimna bar Zimna. How do we know that you give multiple summonses? So the Torah, so here the Gemara has another source from Nevi'im, that you give multiple warnings. And finally, if a person refuses to appear before the Bez Din, how do we know that you issue a Seiruv? How do you know that a contempt order can be issued? This is based on the contempt that was issued against Meroz, that was issued against those who refused to participate in the battle of Devorah and Barak together with Sisera. Orum Meroz, the Meroz was cursed. It was like a contempt was issued against Meroz for failure to participate, for failure to show up when summoned to do their obligation. So based on all these various sources, we have kind of the early scriptural sources for the Hazmana process before the Bez Din. The rules and procedures of the Bez Din of America go further and say that in terms of the issuance of a contempt order, we, even after three summonses have been issued, we also require that there be a 30-day period before a contempt order has been issued. The Gemara talks about Monday, Thursday, Monday. We recognize that sometimes it takes time for mail to arrive, for people to answer their mail, for people to get around to their mail. Since there's a general principle, like in when it comes to Bez Din matters, for example, when a person says, oh, I have evidence that I want to bring in a Bez Din case, but I don't have it available, I want some extra time. So there's the principle, Zman Bez Din Shloshim Yom, that there's the time period that Bez Din generally gives people when they ask for extra time is 30 days. That's the default or typical time period set by Bez Din. So therefore, we apply that same default period for purposes of establishing default when a person refuses to comply with the order to show up before Bez Din, and we therefore have a principle in our rules. In the packet that was just delivered right now, you'll find the copy of the relevant procedures in Article 2 of our rules, that a contempt order requires the passage of 30 days. And as I said, you don't necessarily even need the three Hazmanos. The three Hazmanos are sort of, you know, based on the assumption that the Aruch HaShulchan says sometimes people are too busy, but if you know after the first Hazmana they received it, and they say, oh, we absolutely refuse to come to Bez Din, there isn't necessarily a need to send additional Hazmanos, but we generally wait the 30 days anyway before issuing a contempt order. Now, as I said, the assumption of the case where a contempt order can easily be issued or where a date can easily be set by a particular Bez Din is when that Bez Din has the authority over a particular matter. That authority can be established in one of two different ways. One way that a Bezdin can have authority over matters is if parties have obligated themselves ahead of time to appear before that Bezdin. They could do that by making a kinyan. Kinyan could be a kinyan sudar, it could be a signed arbitration agreement that they have mechayev themselves to come before that particular Bezdin, or it can be by virtue of that Bezdin being the only act in town, what we call a Bezdin kavua. Now, in order for a Bezdin to establish the status of a Bezdin kavua, like we had this with a number of the European towns, for example, the people of the town would essentially accept upon themselves that any dispute that would be held would go in front of this particular Bezdin. And you had such a Bezdin kavua system, at least in Europe. But if you turn to the citation in the Igros Moshe, this is, I think, the second Igros Moshe, on page 3, so Ramosha makes a makes an observation concerning the reality, at least here in the state of New York. So he quotes the Ramah that you also have in the sources. Take a look. This is the last paragraph of the Igros Moshe. The cost of Ramadim Dayan Kvuim Beir Lo Yuchad Lo Yachol Loma Loadim Lifneim. If you do have a Bezdin Kavua, you have an established Bezdin in the city, says the Ramah, you have no right to say that I'm not going to appear before those dayanim. I have to that you must go only in front of those dayanim, and you cannot pick an alternative bezdin. The alternative bezdin might be a different bezdin that also has status, or it might be a bezdin that is convened in the manner which is described in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Chof Gimel Amud Aleph, based on the Mishnah, Zeb Bo'er Lo Echad, Zeb Bo'er Lo Echad, where each side picks one Dayan, and the two Dayanim pick a third Dayan. So let's say a person says, I don't want to go to the established Bezdin, I want to go to a Bezdin of Zeb Bo'er. So it says for Moshe, look, according to the Ramah says explicitly, you have this in the sources as well, that if you have Dayanim Kavuim Be'ir, this is source number 1 on page 3, if there are Dayanim Kavuim Be'ir, says the Ramah, you have no right to say that I am not going to go in front of them, because you have to go in front of that Bezdin. So go back to Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe says, that was only in the cities, in Europe, for example, where there was dayanim who were appointed dayanim from the city, where even the abbezin had the ability to, even the rabbi of the city had the ability to compel people to appear before him, because that was part of his ksav rabbanus. It was kind of like he was appointed the dayan of the city. In various, cities in Europe, there was the dayan of the city, right? Simcha Zelig was the dayan of Brisk. My great-great-grandfather was the Dayan of Rosal. You have different people who had the appellation, they were the Dayan of this or the Dayan of that. But that's only if there is an appointment and an acceptance of the community of such an individual as the Dayan. Me'acha shekiblu, because that's called a Kabbalah. There's an acceptance of that authority. It's kind of what functions in the very same way as a Kinyan. About New York, but in New York, where we are situated, Leka Dayanim Kivuim, Shinismanu Me'ir. There are no city-appointed Dayanim. Certainly the mayor has not appointed any Dayanim. No, it used to be that there was even like a little bit less of a separation between religion and state, that you could have the actual authorities of the city who would give, or the authorities of the government that would give autonomy to the smaller Jewish communities, and they would actually be able to confer a certain amount of authority that these are the people that you are obligated to accept as your dayanim. Obviously, in accordance with halacha, they'd have to be proper dayanim, but we don't have that, and we certainly don't have any kind of Zayin Tuvei Ya'ir type of mechanism over here where there are rabbinic omnismen who are essentially appointed by the people as being their representatives or delegates to decide all religious matters and make all religious appointments on behalf of everybody. Rather, the culture that we live in is more of the shtibla in every single block, culture, minyan in every single, dorm type culture. And therefore, we don't have this type of authority or centralized authority that can compel people before a particular bezdin. In Frat, Shika Od Agudot, also there are many Agudot, right? you have agudot rabbanim, mitzakus rabbanim, igud rabbanim, agudot in name and in form that abound within the city. V'chaburot shav rabbanim, and stadrus rabbanim, and many other organizations of rabbanim. You don't even have an appointment of a centralized resident authority by all the rabbanim of the city. And therefore, if somebody wants to go to an alternative bezin mechanism, such as, for example, to say, I don't even want to go to a formal institutional bezin, such as, say, the bezin of America, or the bezin of Machon Lohiro, the bezin of Igud Rabbanim, or the bezin of Beis Yosef, but I want to do a Zabla bezin, where each person picks a dayan, and the two dayanim pick a third dayan, so a person would have the right to do that as well. And indeed, if you take a look at our rules and procedures, which are somewhere in this, I guess, additional handout. I see it also has the Westlaw summary report. Very good. And this additional handout, we have. I don't. We'll have to find it.
After the Westlaw, I think page 4.
After the Westlaw on page 4. I don't see our rules and procedures there. Hold on. I didn't give the rules and procedures with Jacob, Rabbi Schwartz.
Oh,
I just put it on there. I figured you could get it from the from our webpage.
That I didn't
okay, get not there. So our rules and procedures, Torah Shabbat Perek, go to www.bestin.org and pick up a copy of our rules and procedures. Article 2 gives a respondent party the option to say, yes, I will go to your Bezin of America, let's set a date. Or, I know I want to go to a different Bezin, let's say Bezin of Machon Lahayra. Or option number 3, they can say, you know what, I want to go to a Zabla Bezin where each of us will pick a Boirer, each of us will pick a Dayan, and those two Dayanim will pick a third Dayan, because in New York, where there is no official Bezin Kavua, then you would have the authority to do that. Now, I copied for you the tshuva of the Tashbeis. It's a rather long tshuva in Chelak Al Kuf Nun Tet, where the Tashbeis, basically, based on the Gemara in Baba Basra, Perek Hashutvin, Aches Amud Beis, talks about how the Bnei Ha'ir can make all kinds of takanos. The people of the city can get together, sometimes it's through delegates they've appointed, Zayin Tu Be'ir, they can get together and make all kinds of takanos that this is the way that we're going to do business, this is the way that we're going to, these are some of the takanos that we're going to establish for ourselves. So among the different types of takanos that the Bnei Ha'ir can all get together to establish, it says that Tashbeis, is to appoint specific dayanim, to appoint a specific bezin, that this is going to be the bezin in town that will be the official bezin. And once it is officially sort of accepted by the townspeople, by themselves, or by their delegates, that this is the bezin that's going to be established for the city, says the Tashbeis, even if there are other rabbanim who are in the city, who are arguably bigger Talmidei Chachamim and more knowledgeable and more competent, if this has been the Takana established by the city, that this is our Bezin, then everybody is obligated to go to that Bezin. So one could make the argument that if you had all of the Rabbanim of a city get together and declare to their Balabatim, declare to all of the congregants of their shuls, the Bat Ha'ir, sometimes you have a city like, you know, in Bergen County or in the Raritan Valley, various places, you have a Bat HaRabbanim kind of encompasses all of the Rabbanim of that city or that community. Sometimes the Bat HaRabbanim is the Bat HaRabbanim in name only. It's called the Bat HaRabbanim of, you know, some big city, but 90% of the people in the city don't recognize the Bat HaRabbanim. If you have a Bat HaRabbanim that really does encompass all of the Rabbanim of the city and really is respected by all of the inhabitants of the city, so according to the reasoning of the Tashbeis, arguably one can go a step further and say that maybe the Bat HaRabbanim can get together and say, okay, for all disputes among congregants, among members of our community, we are going to establish that we are the official Bezin, or we are going to either be the official Bezin in town, or we're going to designate the following Bezin as the official Bezin in town. A couple of cases, for example, that came to the Bezin of America where they were community disputes between either members of a community or between, say, a store establishments in a community where, for example, it was a Hasagas Gvul case. Where parties essentially submitted to the Bat HaRabbanim anyway for their hashkafa, And the Vada Rabbanim said, this store is competing with the other store. They're having a dispute, and we designate the Bezdin of America as the official Bezdin that the parties are obligated to go to in order to resolve this dispute. So in such a case, based on the Tashbeis, the Gemara and Baba Basra, one can make the argument that the Bezdin in such a case would receive the status of a Bezdin Kavua for purposes of having the authority to adjudicate the case. Yes? The Ramah at the end of Siman Zion talks about the following cases. Sometimes you might have a Bezdin that's been given authority to decide a particular case, either because of the Bezdin Kavua Shabir, or because of the Bezdin that was agreed upon by the parties, but for one reason or another, that Bezdin has become possible. That Bezdin views itself as inadequate or incompetent to be able to judge the case. Maybe, you know, it's a little bit too close to home, maybe there are pressures, there's lachats. So in such a case, as the Ramah, that Bezdin can say that we, in our authority of Bezdin, are hereby authorizing these other three Dayanim as the Dayanim who have the authority to hear the case. So therefore, even if they start off with as the ones having the authority, there certainly is an argument in cases that are beyond their purview or jurisdiction, they would have the ability to appoint another Bezdin or other Dayanim in their stead to be able to hear the case based on their authority. Again, the Tashbeis indicates that the Bnei Ayir, however defined, have the ability to establish that this is the Bezdin for our city. It doesn't necessarily mean that Bezdin has to be from within their city. It could be we are establishing the Bezdin for our city from outside of our city. It could be, you know, the Bezdin that we live in, you know, a suburban area. There's a big city, you know, nearby, and they have a Bezdin that we like, and that's going to be the Bezdin for all disputes about for our city. It would appear that way. It would appear that way. He has a little bit of a discussion about what if it's sort of, you know, a tirkot to go to a far out place, but, you know, assuming that we're talking about all, you know, relatively in a local, you know, geographic region, it would seem that that would not be problematic. Okay, good. So the Milchas Elazar, Milchas Shlomo, excuse me, I see that this has a caption but not a an actual source. What?
No, it's in the packet.
It's in the packet.
Page D in the packet. Or in the back of the packet, page D.
Page what?
D.
D? Oh, there are letters. Okay.
The ones I got from the library.
Okay, very good. Okay, so the Milchas Shlomo has a very interesting case as well. This is page D in the back of the packet. Milchas Shlomo, one of the posthumous volumes from Chela Gimel of the Milchas Shlomo, Shlomo Zalman Orbach, deals with another case where a Bezdin receives authority sort of in one of the old-fashioned ways, even Bizman Azeh. I think this was a London case because it was written to Rav Avraham Berkovitz, who I think has passed on, who was a dayan, unless it's a different Rav Berkovitz, in which case I apologize, who was a dayan of the Bezdin in London. And and the question became whether a Bezdin who would not otherwise have authority as the Bezdin Kavua in a particular case can assume authority as the Bezdin Kavua in a case where a court says, hey, we have a dispute before us that really should be handled by a Bezdin, and we are designating a specific Bezdin to deal with this case, where the authority of the Bezdin in this case comes sort of in a backhanded fashion, not through the normal mechanisms by which the Jewish community would normally accept the Bezdin, but rather comes through the mechanism where the Arkos, where the civil courts, are actually the ones that are appointing the Bezdin with authority in this case. And this is not an entirely irrelevant factor for the following reason, that the Arkos are relevant to our system not only in a negative sense, but in a positive sense. The negative sense we're all familiar with, we've spoken of in the past, and that is, lifneim lo lifnei akum, that any disputes that occur between members of the Jewish community are supposed to be presented before a Jewish court of Bezdin and not before a civil court based on the first pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim, lifneim lo lifnei akum. The Medrash in Parshas Shoftim, Shoftim and Shoftim titen lecha b'chol she'arecha, states another obvious and yet crucial point, which is, im ein shoftim, ein shoftim, ein shoftim, ein shoftim. That you cannot have an efficient, effective system of shoftim, of judges, of batei din, if you do not have requisite shoftim, if you do not have enforcers to be able to enforce the decision of the Bezdin. You need to have shoftim. The Arkos, Bizman Azeh, primarily function as an arm of the Bezdin in a positive sense, as the shoftim, as the enforcers of the Bezdin's judgment. So while our authority derives from the halakhic obligation of parties to appear before a Beis Din, and there is chayvus to appear before a Beis Din. The ability to have effective Beis Din and to enforce our decisions is one in which we need to rely upon, in part, the arkos, the civil courts, to enforce the Beis Din decision when a party is refusing to comply with a Beis Din decision. And perhaps along those lines, says of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, if I have a case where there is no agreement on a particular Beis Din, where the case would not otherwise be able to proceed in Beis Din, and a court actually makes a declaration that a case should be referred to a specific Beis Din, that would give the Beis Din, at least in his scenario, the authority to be able to handle the case. This was an Aguna case, it seems, because the bracha that he gives at the end of the tshuva is, that you should be able to help out B'nos Yisrael from being Agunot. There was essentially an Aguna dispute. It seems from the facts of the tshuva that it was the woman actually who had taken the man to court, but there was a dispute about his refusal to give a get, and the Beis Din and the court ruled that the case should be referred to the Beis Din in London for or to a Beis Din, that the parties would need to appear before a Beis Din for the resolution of the dispute. This is, you know, sort of the line. If you look in paragraph Aleph, says the Gamma Hatsato Safa, that there was sort of an additional suggestion. Shemet Tavo, this was at that point in the form of suggestion, in Lachish Klal again Ma'usa, you don't have to worry that if they're compelling the person to appear before Beis Din Shel Yisrael, that would lead to again Ma'usa Kiyarkos, Rakoifa Oysel, Afiv Fnei Beis Din Shel Yisrael. They're just forcing him to appear before a Beis Din Shel Yisrael. However, says the, he adds, this is very important paragraph base, if you don't specify the Beis Din, maybe the husband will say, oh, he wants to go before a disreputable Beis Din, a reforming mamash, or non-orthodox Beis Din. Therefore, you have to make it clear, shabrevete rakvi ad isha. Therefore, you have to put the choice in the hands of the woman to make sure that it's a Beis Din that would be able to yield an effective get in this case. Even if the Baal himself is a defendant in the case, that the Isha would have the right to choose the Beis Din she yoytzev, al zeh nochos v'ikarach v'isha, or he v'arei v'adei tivcha v'beis din kosher, and she will choose the Beis Din kosher. But the implication of the tshuva is, once the woman chooses a particular Beis Din, even though it wasn't agreed to by both parties, and the court assigns that Beis Din, so then that Beis Din becomes the Beis Din kavua, becomes the sitting Beis Din in that case. There's no problem with respect to jurisdiction, even though it wasn't actually agreed upon by both parties, and would only be a Beis Din that was appointed by a court. Now, in actuality, this sort of thing comes up from time to time where you have parties, for example, that have signed an arbitration agreement to go before a Beis Din, and for whatever reason the Beis Din proceedings break down and then it ends up in court. And then the court basically is asked to decide, well, should it go in court, or should it go back in Beis Din? Let's say it's a dysfunctional Beis Din. What the courts, at least in New York, have consistently done in those cases is something which is at least more consistent api halacha, which is they say, well, if the previous Beis Din proceedings have broken down, on the other hand, the parties have clearly evidenced their intent to go to Beis Din, so we're not going to take over and have a court proceeding. We'll tell them to go back to Beis Din. We'll tell them that they should do a zabla. But basically, each party picks one dayan, and the two dayanim pick a third dayan. So the zabla is generally the default proposition of what to do when parties can't agree upon a Beis Din, as we'll discuss a little further anyway. And therefore, this generally does not become problematic, especially if the court is not appointing the judges. In fact, even a Beis Din that has received kind of, you know, a direction from the court that they are to handle a particular case might come to the conclusion that the way in which they're going to handle the case, according to halakhic principles, based on the willingness of the parties to come before that Beis Din or a different Beis Din, is to oversee some sort of zabla process as well. And that's another possibility that Beis Din could encounter in this type of scenario. Now, speaking about Bezin of Zabla, which we spent, you know, sometimes speaking about up until now, Bezin Shel Zabla is a tricky proposition. The reason why it's a tricky proposition is because if we're dealing with institutional Batei Din, like, say, Bezin of America, Machol Mahayro, whatever institutional Bezin we're talking about, there are certain rules and principles that guide the Dayanim, that the Dayanim are expected to abide by. We even have published rules and procedures. But even without our published rules and procedures, the Bezin can simply say, take a look at Chosh Mishpat Simonim Aftuch Abav. Dayanim are supposed to follow certain procedures. They're not supposed to have ex parte communications with the parties. They're supposed to not be no gay abidover. They're not supposed to have an interest in the outcome of the case. There are laws about how fees, if any, are paid to avoid shochet issues and things of that variety. So, generally speaking, it can be expected, or it is expected, that the Dayanim in regular Batei Din are abiding by all of these rules. If you have a Zabla proceeding, what a Zabla proceeding means is that each party picks a Dayan, and those two Dayanim pick a third Dayan. Now, when a person picks a Dayan, if they're picking a Dayan who happens to be a Dayan from a regular Beis Din, so then there's really no issue with respect to these concerns. But if they're picking somebody who's not really a regular Dayan, but is somebody who's more of an advocate on their behalf, so it raises various issues. Now, Rashi in Sanhedrin on Daf Chav Gimel Amud Aleph, when the Gemara there sort of lauds the suitability of a Zabla process. So Rashi there says, this is on page 7 of the first handout, Rashi says, through a Zabla process, the Gemara indicates the cases of Yetze Din Emes Lamito. Actually, the Gemara says Yetze Din Lamito, Rashi seems to have a gear say Yetze Din Emes Lamito. So Rashi says, Yetze Din Emes Lamito, the Tzaisi Balei Adinin, because the Balei Dinin will be compliant, will be agreeable with the Bezin process, the Savachai Varani Be'atzmi Garati Echod, because the one who ends up losing will say, look, I had a choice, I had a hand in choosing one of the Dayanim, Ma'yayachol Apik V'skusi Yem Apik, and if he had the ability to argue on my behalf, he would have. Dayanim Asma Noicha Daitim Apik V'skush Neim Neisha Shneim B'birum. And the Dayanim themselves are comfortable to promote the interest and the arguments of both sides because they know that they've been chosen by both sides. At least the first two Dayanim were chosen by both sides. The third Dayan is chosen by the two Dayanim, but everybody feels comfortable with the process. So says the Rosh, this is source 2 on page 7, he says, you could be susceptible to misinterpreting Rashi. And how could Rashi be misinterpreted? He says, there are those who make a mistake with respect to the words of Rashi, that a Dayan is obligated to argue on behalf of the one who chose him, and even to make arguments and to, you know, cover up things are not according to the halacha. And there are people who will pick as their borer, shady and tricky individuals. V'nitzlim midivei Rashi, and they'll say, well, according to Rashi, I can pick a gangster. Shemashra sheyesh v'lahapek v'sklusov, because after all, isn't that their job to argue on behalf of the person who chose them? V'chalina v'chas! No way! God forbid! That's not what Rashi meant. Because of the Sarani Barati, what Rashi means is Kihusovia Ken Shiafek Viskuso. The party will feel comfortable that if there was exclusive, if there was any kind of merit to their case, the giant that they chose is the giant that they feel comfortable that this is a person who would recognize that Sukhus. Yati Viskusa Akum talks at Sayas Ludinam, a Dayan Atzmo. But the Dayan himself, Khalila Lolim Sosval is Akai. So the Dayan is not supposed to try to advocate or to try to push the case of the person who chose him more, in Lo Shiyirlo Din Gamo, unless he sees that the merits of the case are on that person's side. However, if the Dayan is simply trying to trick the other side so that his side can prevail and trick the other Dayanim, even though he's not sure that his side really is correct as a matter of halacha, that is a perversion of justice. Since he was selected by that party, so it means that he will at least make sure that he understands what that person is arguing. And if there is any merit to the argument, he'll make sure that it's considered. V'chein na'ol se'a dayin ha'akal sheni, and the other dayin will do so as well. Nitzal onishos kus nispa menelam shneim, so that none of the, at least, meritorious arguments will be lost to both of them. V'ashlishi shumei ha'masen matan shel shneim, achriya b'nei miyot se'a din lamito, and the third dayin can hear all the arguments and help to put things in proper perspective. But says the Rosh, chalila v'chas, that the idea is that the dayan who is selected by one party should be the advocate on behalf of that party. So this is a major issue with respect to Zablas nowadays. This one major issue is the notion of people choosing essentially rabbinic advocates to be their borer in a Zabla process. So according to the rules, or according to the policies, I should say, of the Bezdin of America, generally will allow a party to reject the other party's choice of a dayan based on the notion that the other dayan is essentially serving as an advocate for the other side if they pick somebody who's really a rabbinic advocate to be their dayan. And we very much encourage parties to pick people who are genuine dayanim. And in fact, if you take a look at the last line of the Rosh, if one of the parties says, I'm going to pick the Nitva in this case, says I'm going to pick a Dayan who's not appropriate, but the other party's willing to choose a Dayan who is appropriate, so then we say that would be obligated to argue your case in front of the three Dayanim, who are regular dayanim, or you should pick a dayan who is in fact appropriate. What you have sometimes is that one party wants to pick, you know, an advocate, and the other party says, I don't want them to pick an advocate, but I'll pick an advocate. So if both parties, you know, want to pick advocates, you can't argue against the other side's, you know, picking of an advocate. If you want to reject the other person's advocate, so they should have the right to reject your advocate. But says the Rosh that, you know, you have to, if you're going to, you know, that the only time that you really have the right to strike, you know, what we call Dayan She'eno Hogun, is if you've chosen, in fact, a Dayan Hogun. So there are some Zabla processes where both parties basically are moichel, shall we say, that they waive any objection. They say, okay, this person's a rabbinic advocate and you've chosen as a judge, but I'll also choose a rabbinic advocate, and we'll both be makabel this situation upon ourselves, and therefore it won't be a problem. But a party ostensibly has the right to say, I don't want you to pick a rabbinic advocate as a judge based on the Rosh. Now, there are other problems with Bayer, with the Bayer system, and the other problem is that sometimes there's sort of a feeling of camaraderie. A person picks a Bayer, and it means that not only they take it a step further, not only is the person expected to be an advocate, but they actually meet with them, and they go over the case, and they have all kinds of private meetings with this person who's essentially a dayan on the case, something that would be unheard of in connection with a regular dayan. So the Aruch HaShulchan already notes this practice in his days. This is the source at the bottom of page 7, I guess going over to the top of page 8. And the Aruch HaShulchan says, Af al pi she'bayrim yeshlem kol dinei dayanim, even though the bayrim have all the rules of dayanim that are applicable to them, we can also look at baldin la'tziyat v'aynos l'pnei bayr shiloh, so therefore each baldin should not be allowed to present his claims in front of his bayrim, below baldin chaveiro, in the absence of the other party, we call makom k'far nogu. So this Aruch HaShulchan seems to indicate that there's already a minhag that everybody kind of meets privately with their buyer, and since both parties engage in this practice, a minhag came, and that's the minhag who have a ki'ilu kiblu aleihem shnei asadim loif and zeh. And it's as if both parties have explicitly agreed to this, and it's an issue, in which case there will no longer be a prohibition with respect to this issue. So the counter argument is, that's all fine and good if that's the minhag, but parties can say, it's not my minhag. We don't have necessarily a minhag America with respect to this. So many people, especially in recent years, where there's really been an outcry of how the Zabla system has come to work over the years, have cried out against this, that they don't want this practice. They're not mekabel. The Aruch HaShulchan says, it's as if they're mekabel. See, if they have to have somebody screaming and shrieking, I'm not mekabel. I don't want the other person to meet privately with their borer, and I'm not going to meet privately with their borer. So Mistama, they have the schus to be able to make that argument. These concerns were raised as well in the Pisgei Tshuva, Choshe Mishpat, Simen Beis, Sif Gimel. I'm assuming that's at the end of the new packet in one of the letters.
At the end of the old packet.
Yeah. Oh, it actually made it to the end of the old packet in the letters. Right. Okay. So that would be
page G.
Page what?
G.
So if you take a look at page G, Aruch HaShulchan Sif Gimel. This isn't Holy Night. It's a different Biskei Tshuva I want. So that's also a... all right, we'll throw in this Biskei Tshuva too. This Biskei Tshuva is also important. The Biskei Tshuva, I'm sorry?
It's ENF,
maybe? ENF is probably, that's probably it, but let me get back to that one. So this Biskei Tshuva, which is also relevant to this discussion, on the other one is the Biskei Tshuva Yud Gimel Gimel. It's Simon Yud Gimel Sif Gimel. All right, so I'll read that one first. So Simon Gimel Yud Gimel Sif Katan Gimel Nepitzchei Tshuva. I guess it starts on page E. Okay, so you go to the bottom. It's a long Nepitzchei Tshuva. Raises some of these concerns. He says, no, it's not so long. It starts here about 5 lines to the bottom. Says Vayein, second line, B'tshuvas Panim Me'ivah Shikasu Da'asal P'yadin La'akim Tanayis Tzkil Lepnei Abayir. He writes, it's prohibited. There's no Abayir is no different from a regular Dayan. One cannot raise their claims before in a private fashion before their Abayir. Kal v'chom Da'asal Lipsog Lo Skar B'shuvas Akayis Abedin. And he certainly can't pay him on the side. Yizeb Olo Echem Kol Taris Ayonim Aleim. So the Apeskei Tshuva raises another concern which you also hear about, which is the notion of people kind of paying their borrower on the side, so they're getting sort of a disproportionate fee from what everyone else in the case is getting. So these are Beherik Shem Techachim Gula Kilkol Ador Binyan Zeh, and already in their time there was considered a big kilkol, Elzabalus Goran, the Siam Shivoy Lamanike Adul Aksim Akshela Zos Misrael, the Chaim Roy Lino Kashir, he says a much better system would be that there would be permanent dayanim who would be appointed and everybody gets paid out of a public fund. And therefore you'd avoid the pitfall of everybody paying their bayrim separately and people getting paid a separate amount. And he also throws in that he thinks another takana should be in the end on the next page. That people should not pick dayanim or either who either have love relationships or hate relationships with either party from beforehand in order to avoid these pitfalls. So you have basically the three pitfalls of the Zabla process that need to be avoided, and why the Zabla process isn't necessarily always a perfect process. The three pitfalls are, number one, the possibility of ex parte communications between the party and the buyer. Number two, the rush is concerned that the buyer would not serve as an advocate for the party that selected him. And number three, the concern of money paid on the side. And those are basically reasons why there's more of an effort, I would say, in recent times to crack down on the Zabla process to make sure that the Bayerim are essentially people with the same credentials and with the same outlook as regular Dayanim. At the same time, the Aruch HaShulchan also in Siman Beis, Sif Katan Gimel, on page G, talks about the Shavus Yaakov spoke about a case where there was the Kehillin Mitz that wanted that had a practice where all cases would be decided by Zabla, and they wanted to do away with the Zabla system that had already been set up in order to establish a Beis Din Kavua. And he says, don't mess with the existing system because there are merits to the Zabla system. It's about 5 lines from the end. Since it's already a minig in the city and it's a minig that's based on a Gemara, so you can't change the minig. But Pratos is manim elu, and he says that especially nowadays, and here's a zinger, the Biskei Tshuva says, you know what, I have a zinger later on in Siman Yud Gimel against the Barim who are chosen in Zabla process. He's not going to give a zinger against the Dayanim who are in regular Bat Din. They're not necessarily immune from criticism either. He says, the Pratos is manim elu, he says that are relatives, when Manhiga Ir, that aren't really qualified, Mashenke and Bezabla, she says, okay, Nezabla, Achmiya Echaman Eno Hogun, she have a Piskus Baldino, so one of them won't be proper because he's going to be an advocate for one side. Abu Shalopa Apiyadin, he's going to advocate even though it's not halakhically warranted. The Komakam Kinsha Shani Baragamkin the Mishia. So since the second guy is also going to choose an advocate, he's also going to do the same thing. So therefore he says it's as if everyone says, you know, accepted that this is a better system because at least, you know, so this guy has, you know, an advocate. I also have an advocate. Therefore he's seen in many kilos, even though there is a best in Kavua, sometimes in big matters, where there's a concern, I suppose, in Negias of the Dayanim, they figure better an imperfect Zabla system than an imperfect Bezdin Kavua system. Today, Shiyetze Hadin La Amito. So therefore, it's of course important, and it should go without saying, that if one is going to correct the abuses with respect to Zablos, one has to make sure that there are no abuses with respect to who the people are who are sitting as the Dayanim Kavuim of the Bezdin Kavua. Yes?
You initially presented the Zablos system as a way to avoid the issue of not being able to agree on a particular investment to meet in front of, yeah?
Well, the Zabla system is an alternative Bezdin. In other words, if you don't have a Bezdin Kavua, then a party, according to the Din of the Gemara, has the right to say, I don't want to go in front of this particular Bezdin, I want to go in front of a Zabla. I want to go in front of a Bezdin where each party chooses one Dayan, and those two Dayanim pick a third Dayan. But the pitfalls that we're discussing are that when that occurs, it is important to ensure that the Dayanim who are chosen satisfy the requirements of what of how they're supposed to behave in order to sit on a proper Bezdin panel.
So, I mean, you said there's been a recent attempt to crack down in terms of, I guess, coming up with remedies for these pitfalls. In terms of enforcement, how do you do that?
Okay, so there are a number of different suggestions. You know, the Baragola that is somewhere on these sources, or at least I thought it was. What?
Page C.
Page C. Okay, we're going sort of backwards in the letters here. So the Baragola talks about the following situation. Now, a Zabla can occur sort of, you know, in one of several different ways. A Zabla can occur when parties kind of initially say, let's do a Zabla. It can occur where the Tovea says, I want to go to a Bezdin, and it's not a Bezdin Kavua, and the Nifra says, no, I don't want to go to a Bezdin Kavua, I want to go to a Zabla. Says the Baragola, what about the following scenario? And this is sort of the much more common case that occurs nowadays in my Bezdin experience. Ruvain says, I want to go to Bezdin A, and Shimon says, I want to go to Bezdin B. Neither one of them have really initiated the notion of a Zabla. So what should be the answer in such a case? So says the Baragola this is the Baragola that says two asterisks, so you're two asterisks, okay? It talks about the situation when you have Shnei Tamidei Chachamim Birachas, okay? Meaning I have two Batei Din, essentially, in one city. Neither one is the best in Kavua, but they're both fine established Batei Din, right? So one wants to go to one Bezdin, and the other wants to go to the other Bezdin. So says the Baragola, Pirishu Yochel Ha'akev Echad Al-Chavero, Utsrich Limbo Bezdin Ashav L'Shneim. That neither side can insist on a particular Bezdin, and they both together have to agree to a Bezdin Ashav L'Shneim. They have to both agree to a Bezdin that they both find mutually acceptable. So one solution in these types of cases, if one person says Bezdin A and the other one says Bezdin B, is say, okay, we can't agree on Bezdin A or Bezdin B, but maybe we can agree on Bezdin C. So once a kana that's been proposed by a network of different batei din, although it hasn't become and is sufficiently widespread to become sort of the official policy all over, is that if parties can't agree on a particular Bezdin, then you have the Nipah says, I don't want to go to the Bezdin that was suggested by the Tovea, so he gives three or four alternative batei din. I'd be happy to go to any of these three or four alternative batei din, and as long as they're all respectable batei din, say, from within the network of respectable batei din, so then the Tovea will have to choose one of them, because after all, the Nipah is giving forth, you know, a number of different batei din. Alternatively, the Baragola says, you know, let them try to find the Bezdin Ashavet. If they can't find the Bezdin Ashavet, then you have to pick a Bezdin Ashavet from those Batei Din that have been proposed. What we've done more frequently to avoid these pitfalls is to say, you know what, we have a case where the parties can't agree on a particular Bezdin. So we're going to convert the case, is what our rules and procedures say, we'll convert the case to a zabla. This is the minhag, so we convert the case in such a case to a zabla. But let's not make this into a normal zabla. Let's do the following. Party Reuven wants to go to Bezdin A. Shimon wants to go to Bezdin B. So instead of just picking rabbinic advocates, Tohanim, to serve as the Boerim and a Zabla, have Reuven pick a Dayan from Bezdin A. In fact, have Bezdin A even appoint the Dayan. It's not even appointed by Reuven. That would be even better. Have Bezdin B appoint the Dayan for Shimon, and then those two Dayanim will appoint the third Dayan. We've had on more than one occasion, for example, cases where Reuven wants to go to Bezdin of America, Shimon wants to go to Bezdin Mechon Lahira. So Bezdin of America has appointed Dayan A, Mechon Lahira has appointed Dayan B. Dayan A and Dayan B have appointed, say, Rabbi Landisman from Bezdin of Kol HaRabonim as Dayan C. And you end up having three objective Dayanim, each appearing from institutional bodies. Then the objective of Zabla is still served because each person feels, okay, I wanted to go to that Bezdin, so I got a Dayan appointed by that Bezdin, so therefore I have a comfort level, and you have all of the objectives of Zabla served without any of the pitfalls with God's help. So this is, you know, one possible solution to the problem. Now, there is a principle that's articulated by the Rama in Siman Yud Aleph. I think it's Siman Yud Dalet. Siman Yud Dalet Sif Aleph, where the Rama does articulate a principle, and it's important just to mention this because it's important to reckon how this functions, and that is Hochen Achar HaNitba, that we go after the Nitba, meaning what? Meaning that if the Tobeah lives in one location, the Nitba lives in a different location, so then it's the obligation of the Tobeah to go to the Makam of the Nitba for the Din Torah. So does that mean that the Nitba then really has the right to choose the Bezdin that he wants to go to? So it's generally understood that this is really more of a geographical halacha, meaning if I have a Bezdin Kavua in the Tobeah's town, and I have a Bezdin Kavua in the Nitba's town, Tobeah being claimant, the Nitba being the defendant, the Tobeah, the claimant, is obligated to go to the defendant's town, to the Bezdin Kavua in the defendant's town to hear the case, rather than insisting that his Bezdin Kavua hear the case. However, let's say that Reuven and Shimon both live in the same town, there are many Batei Din in that town, or they live in different towns, but there's no Bezdin Kavua in either town. It's the same, you know, panoply of Batei Din. One of them lives in Manhattan, and the other one lives in West Orange, there's no Bezdin Kavua in Manhattan, there's no Bezdin Kavua in West Orange, that they all basically go to the same class of Batei Din. So what this halakha would mean at the most is that if the Nipa insisted that the Din Torah be held in his backyard, that whatever Bezdin was chosen would go to his backyard, or if it would be more pertinent if, for example, you had the Nipa, the Tobeah, in New York, and the Nipa lives in California, so the Nipa would not be obligated to travel from California to New York. There are exceptions to the rule where there are assets that are subject to the dispute that are in New York, and the defendant is in California, and the assets are frozen in New York, and therefore they can argue this is the place where the assets are, and have the Nipa come to the makam of the makam of the Tobeah. I excerpted, or I copied, at the end of the second handout, pages 96 and 121, from Rav Shulchan Ben Sefer Sidur HaDin, different case scenarios of what's considered to be the makam of the Nipa for purposes of establishing when the Tobeah has to go to the geographical location of the Nipa, in which he points out that the modern-day reality is that sometimes there are multiple reasonable locations that could be sort of established as the main geographical location rather than simply where the parties live. For example, let's say a party lives in one location, but the company that's subject to the dispute, or the business that's subject to the dispute, is in a different location. So he says here this is one of the issues that was dealt with in the Takanos of the Batei Din Rabbanim, and they came to the conclusion that there were three different places that could be viewed as the Makom and the Nipa. Kim Karmashon Nipa Yiru Es Mekom Migura v'akavua, in a place where the person lives, where the defendant lives, makom avoda so akavua, the place where the person works, oh, makom iska v'karayayim, or if the person's work requires them to travel a great deal to the place where they generally are in, are situated for business purposes, okay? The im, and then it goes on to say, Mafia klolim asher v'sifa koidim yoysim v'beisin ezori echa nekshag v'beisin shemakom v'nipa. And if you find that there are multiple locations that could sensibly be the place where the nitva is situated, a brei v'yada tovea l'chor v'echa v'batei din eilo, then the tovea will have the right to choose one of these three batei din, because each one of these three locations could arguably be viewed as makom v'nipa. And then if you turn to page 121, he also brings the Moshe Klal v'sisi a tovea l'chor v'nipa. Despite the general principle that the tovea goes after nipa, yeshna mikrim she'ena das tovea from chiyuv shel tovea v'gosh shesiv makom shel nipa. There are cases where it doesn't really make sense. Okay, for example, v'duma mikrim shemem atviya amasin nesek or av lacher she'asa nes tovea l'nipa ve'esem miskav odash shachar shenipa gam nesek tovea yechuyev atovea v'tzaros otircha kuchem v'gosh shesiv atviya makom shel nipa. Let's say that the nipa did something terrible or allegedly did something terrible to tovea. Where did tovea live? And then the nipa runs off to New Zealand, right? You know, and now, you know, runs away to escape the long arm of the law, right? In some place in Australia or land down under, whatever, in New Zealand. And now, is it fair to make the claimant have to travel all this way because the guy is running away? So wouldn't it be fair in such a case, okay? So therefore, there are these types of considerations that would provide exceptions to the rule of Hokin Achar HaNipa. Now it so happens that the Nesivos, and I have this in the Maran Mekomos as well, I try to figure out, I think it's Nesivos Os Gimel, right? In the dealing with Bezin Shel Zabla and Simon Yud Gimel, right? It's a Simon Yud Gimel Os Gimel, I believe.
Simon
Yud Dalet. Oh, Simon Yud Dalet Os Gimel. We made a correction, right? I had originally said Yud Gimel, it's actually Yud Dalet Os Gimel. So the Nesivos says that if they can't agree on a Bezin, then they should try to then several, but as I mentioned to you, he just say he
it's in the first packet, page 8.
It's the first packet, page
8.
Page 8. So the Nesivos proposes sort of the same idea that you should have multiple batei din. He says they can both disagree until they're able to agree upon a bez and a shovel like the baragola, right? Then he goes further, he says, if they can't agree, then have those two batei din sort of sit together. And that's along the lines, I think, of what I mentioned to you, we do if one party says Bezin of America, another party says Machon Noira, so we kind of get together, right? And then he says, if the two batei din don't want to sit together, as I nipa koyecha gadol, so then he claims that the nipa has the upper hand, given she eshla kapaisa kishavala Bezin, and he writes there, since you can't, you know, compel him to go to a particular Bezin, so then he has the right, as long as he picks a reputable Bezin, to say, you have to come to my Bezin. In practice, however, as Rabbi Willick points out in his an article he wrote a few years ago in the Beis Yitzchak, the practice is not like the Nesivos. The practice is more along the lines that whenever there is no official Bezin Kavua in the city, there are multiple Batei Din, the parties continuously retain the right to go to a Zabla, and you just try to control the Zabla process as much as possible. But as far as the first suggestion of the Nesivos, that if your one party picks Bezin A and the other person picks Bezin B, if both batei din are willing to sit together to convene the case, so that's something which we certainly believe in, and which we have tried to push. One can be medayik in the lashon of the Ramah at the end of Simon Gimel Sif Aleph, that the Ramah seems to indicate that whenever you don't have dayanim kivuim, then you end up actually in Machaben Ramah. If you in any case where you don't have dayanim kivuim, then the case would be converted to a zabla, because the Machaber says it's 3 lines from the bottom of that source, which is source 1 on page 3. So the Mechaber says, if the Nipa is willing to have the case with the Toveya in the Toveya city, right? El she'eno chofetz v'shloisha shibira ha-Toveya, but doesn't want the three that the Toveya chose, so then the case becomes subverted to a zablok, and look, on Simon Yud Gimel. Then the Ramah is, that's only if you don't have beds in Kavua, and if you have a beds in Kavua, then he can't say then he can't say that I insist upon a zablok. But from the Pasha Losh and the Machabe there in Simon Gimel, seems to give a basis for the Minog, exactly like the Nesivus, who says that if you can't agree on a Bezin and a Shabbat, or the Bati Din can't work together, so then if the Nipper gets to pick the Bezin, so the Lashon there and the Mechaber seems to be more in accordance with the general Minog. Now, when parties say, I am going to come to a Bezin, what if they say, I'm going to come to a Bezin, but I'm not going to sign the Shtar Beruin? First of all, what's the Shtar Beruin? Shtar Beruin is the term that we use basically to describe the arbitration agreement that's signed between the parties. Now, the Shtar Beruin is mentioned in the Mishnah Bava Metzia, talks about finding a Shtar Beruin. So the Mishnah there that talks about Shtar Beruin, the Gemara asks the question, what is a Shtar Beruin? And we're talking about all kinds of different shtaros. What exactly is a Shtar Beruin? So the Gemara says that there are two opinions. One opinion is it's talking about shtari ta'anasa, it's talking about documents in which the claims of the parties are written. The other opinion is Rabbi Yirmiyah Amar Zebor lo echad v'zebor lo echad, that shtari beruvin are each party has the right, it's a shtar in which says who the parties are picking as their dayan. In other words, when you have a zabla, so you need a shtar beruvin that stipulates who the parties are picking as their dayanim, so that they are mekabel upon themselves these dayanim, and they can't go back upon their kabbalah once that they're choosing these dayanim once they've signed the shtar beruvin. Effectively, once you acknowledge that you have a system where there is no bezdin kavua, where there is no established institutionalized bezdin, then you always need a shtar beruvin, because whoever you're going to select, it's not automatic that you're going to appear before a specific bezdin once there is no bezdin kavua. So you always need a shtar in order to say that you're mekabel upon yourself the authority of these dayanim. You're mekabel the authority of this bezdin. You're mekabel the authority of these dayanim. So you always need a shtar beruvin in order for people to evidence their commitment that they are not going to go back on a particular dayanim. We have other, there's a potential pitfall with respect to a shtar beruvin, because the shtar beruvin accomplishes at least that they can't go back with respect to the choice of these dayanim. But what about their obligation to follow the psak of the dayanim? So if I'm only dealing with a shtar, we know that a shtar is good enough to be mechayev a person, like for certain types of transactions, like karkos, but a shtar is actually not good for mitalfin, says the Gemara Kedusha Chavav. It's also not good for ma'os, right, to conduct a transaction merely with a shtar alone. So if in the event that there is some sort of obligation which is going to be beyond just accepting these people as dayanim, but when it comes to the psak din, so how have the people been mechayev themselves? Perhaps for this reason, most batei din also have the practice that the dayarim do a kinyan sudar, that they're going to sort of accept upon themselves a hitzchayvus, an obligation with respect to any kind of judgment that will be issued, any type of psak din that will be issued by the Bez Din. But in addition to that, the Sma says that if the Shtar Beruvin contains a Lashon Hitzchayvus, so people always have the ability according to Halacha to be mischayev themselves to anything, to any kind of payment, any kind of obligation. We have the people can be if the Lashon Hitzchayvus, then you don't need any other type of kinyan. That's why you have, well, people can make all kinds, I can be mischayev myself to pay you $1 million, okay? You don't need any other type of kinyan if you have a Lashon Hitzchayvus. It says the Sma, if you have a Lashon Hitzchayvus in the Shtar Beruvin, that should be sufficient even without any other type of kinyan for whatever psak the Bez Din is going to order. So it so happens that this kind of that this kind of lashon of hiskayvus that is insisted upon by the Sma or recommended by the Sma for Shtari Beruin, where is that arbitration agreement?
After page 8 before page 9.
Of which handout? The regular handout?
Yes.
Okay. So between pages 8 and page 9, you have the sample form arbitration agreement of the Beis Din of America. Okay? So our language is essentially the language that is recommended also by the American Arbitration Association, which also say that there should be a lashon of accepting upon themselves the decision as a binding decision. And if you have this lashon, which is kind of their English version of lashon hiskayvus, that since this is sort of the English version of the lashon hiskayvus, that you're accepting a decision as a binding decision, so that gives tokef to the arbitration agreement. So by the same token, since I would submit for English purposes, this type of language is viewed as a lashon hiskayvus, that this is, since we're dealing with English language over here and not Hebrew language, that this is probably sufficient to constitute a lashon hiskayvus, which says set parties that agree that they have selected the aforementioned Beis Din to resolve their disputes, and shall accept the ruling of the arbitrator or arbitrators appointed by that organization as a binding decision. They accept it upon themselves as binding. Alternatively, even if one would argue that this itself is not a requisite lashon hiskayvus, the shtar beruin would still be binding upon the parties as a sufficient kinyan, according to the argument of Rabbi Yoezer Ariel in his article about shtar beruin in Tchumen, which is in the materials, in which he argues that me tam situmta, that once I have an accepted form of obligation that is accepted by regular secular society as a sufficient form of kinyan for particular purposes, and people enter into that type of kinyan, whether it's a handshake, which is a more classical form of situmta, or whether it's some other form of situmta, then he says the shtar beruin will be completely binding upon the parties for as a mitora situmta, as a kinyan that would be binding from a situmta perspective. Now, he also argues in his article that there are other advantages or other reasons to enter into the shtar beruin. One reason to enter into the shtar beruin as well is because pshara tzricha kinyan, that the batei din nowadays generally decide cases, this is a source I have in the materials, right, so the Shulchan Aruch and Siman Yudah Beis, Sifchof, says that a Beis Din should try as much as possible to avoid deciding cases according to strict din, that it should take into account equitable considerations, what we call pshara, equitable considerations, but for the parties to agree upon equitable considerations, they need a kinyan for that, and therefore the shtar beruin, and the shtar beruin is one form of the parties accepting upon themselves pshara, as is codified in Shulchan Aruch, the parties can accept upon themselves through signing the shtar beruin that they are going to that they are going to abide by even a pshara determination of the Beis Din, and therefore a shtar beruin is useful for those purposes as well. In addition, getting back to sort of the secular law premise of, you know, that you're supposed to have certain language that it be enforceable, another reason why parties, as a simple matter, need to sign a shtar beruin and should not rely simply on the kinyan that is made, on the kinyan sudar that is made, is because the kinyan sudar would probably not have any meaning from a would probably not have any meaning with respect to the enforceability of the secular law courts of the arbitration decision, because they don't really hold by Kenyan Kenyan Suder. So therefore, in order to ensure that the decisions be enforceable as a matter of arbitration law, it is necessary to have the parties sign an arbitration agreement. And Rabbi Bleich, in the excerpt that I copied from his article in Tradition about litigating before secular courts, goes so far as to say that Bizman Hazeh, since the decision of the Beis Din would not be able to be enforceable without a binding arbitration agreement signed by the parties, if a party says, I will come to Beis Din, but I refuse to sign an arbitration agreement, that is tantamount to the party saying, I refuse to come to Beis Din altogether, and a Beis Din can issue a tzeirus, a Beis Din can issue a contempt order against the party who refuses to sign an arbitration agreement. You ever have a situation where the arbitration agreement accomplishes something that the suitor, you know, would not have been able to accomplish? So yeah, so if you look at the article that I wrote about civil law, Jewish law, civil procedure, I have certain, you know, scenarios where, for example, if I have an arbitration agreement that is witnessed, then that might enable somebody more tokev to be able to collect from mishubadim, as opposed to if I have a kinyan sudar without the edim, then you wouldn't necessarily, you know, have the same, you wouldn't necessarily have that. But again, since the arbitration agreement functions as situmta, probably even without Adem signing the arbitration agreement, you would have the right to go after somebody's encumbered assets. You probably have the right to be able to go after their mishubadim. Our general practice, in any event, is that in addition to having the party sign an arbitration agreement, we usually do have them sign a kinyan sudor as well. The question arises that what if a party says, I'll sign an arbitration agreement, but I'm not going to sign the arbitration agreement to give the Beis Din authority to decide according to pshara, according to compromise, according to equity, but only in accordance with strict din. Do they have the right to do that? So this is getting ready to letter hey in the materials, din versus pshara. There is a discussion in the Gemara in Sanhedrin about whether it is preferable for a Beis Din to decide in accordance with din, or whether it's preferable to decide according to pshara. And there are different, very strong opinions in the Gemara over there. The Gemara quotes Rabbi Eliezer ben Oshel, Rabbi Yossi Aglili, as saying, Asa litzoa. Can't do it, you know. No compromises, no pshara. You know, we used to have a fellow with Moshe Shakola, right? Who used to, I don't know if you remember this Rebbe Schwartz before your day. The fellow who used to always say, no pshara, no compromises. That we have a Yikov Adin Sahar. That we have a very strict, system of halacha, and we're not going to be mevater in anything, and we're not going to have any kind of compromises. So Rabbi Yehuda ben Asher Aglili is sort of the strongest proponent of that. He says, "Us litzor v'chol b'tzei reisa chote." Anybody who's b'tzeia is chote. Then he seems to go on to say that if that's within the technical judicial system, but if you want to operate outside of the system and make shalom between people, kind of, and have them agree on compromises outside of the court system, like Aaron was always shalom odiv shalom, kol hakavod. But within, you know, the Bezin system, no pshara. And then comes along Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha says, mitzvah litzoa. Not only is it not a prohibition, but it's a mitzvah litzoa. It's a compromise, right? You know, that's like the Gemara Baba Metzia says, the Yerushalayim was only destroyed because they were in Higus Asmam, that she'asu kefid dinei Torah. That they acted in accordance with Dinei Torah. Is that they didn't act? Is that so terrible to act in accordance with Din Torah? So the Gemara says, yeah, they insisted on only acting in Din Torah. But then they didn't go beyond the letter of the law. They weren't willing to compromise at all. So that reflects the sentiment of Rabbi Shua Ben Korcha, that it's a mitzvah to bend a little bit. It's a mitzvah to compromise. And Amar, Emes u'mishpat shalom shiftu b'sha'arechem. We should have truthfulness and proper justice in your gates. What do you mean? If there's strict justice, there's no peace, because, you know, somebody can lose their shirt. And if there's peace, they mishpat. So that means, you know, that you bend things a little bit. No, you can have both. You can have, you know, mishpat and shalom together. And this is bitzua. Bitzua, strictly speaking, means compromise. We'll see that the Gemara links or lumps together the word bitzua with the lasha with the word pshara, the Rav Soloveitchik, the Tzal is famous. As articulating the notion that pshara doesn't mean like people commonly say or find them saying that you like split the baby in half, right? That it just means compromise, everything is 50-50. It's what the Gemara and Baba Basra calls Dayane Chatasta. The Dayan that would just, Kuflam and Gimel, would just sort of slice the baby in half. That's not a sign of Dayanim who are learned. That's considered to be something to be disparaged. The Dayanim would just say, okay, you say this, you say that, let's split it in half. That's not what pshara means. Pshara means that you take into account all of the equities of the situation, all of the circumstances, what's fair and just, making peace between the parties, but without losing complete sight of what the din is. Says the Gemara further on, source number 2 on page 9, that Amar Rav, Halacha Rabbi Shimon ben Korcha, the Halacha is like Rabbi Shimon ben Korcha. So that says the Gemara, Rafuna Tamini the Rav Pavak, Yabba also the Kamini Rafuna, but Rafuna was the time of the Rav when the din came in front of him, Amar Louis Bedina recently Bishavisu. He gave parties the choice. He said, if you want, you can have strict in Torah, you can have the letter of the law, or you can have compromise, you can have equity, right? The Rav would say, you have Yoshev, Yoshev is the Rav's term, or you can have Shara. So my mitzvah now is the cover of Rishon Mekorcha mitzvah the main malu. Dina mitzvah b'shav yisur. So says the Gemara. That's what the when Rabbi Yisur Mekorcha says mitzvah, he doesn't mean that you can insist on pshara per se. He means that you try very hard to persuade the parties, right? That you say to the parties, listen, you know, you should you have the option. Okay, you have the option of doing pshara, and not merely the option, you also have the option of doing din, but the idea is that you try to sort of encourage the parties to do pshara. That's what Rashi says. Rashi's source on page 10, Rashi, no number there, mitzvah lemeim liberesha, idina mitzvah pshara, mitzvah debachkinim pshara. Says Rashi that there is a mitzvah to be poseach, to start off in pshara. So even though the first words out of your mouth, technically speaking, it sounds like is the first words out of your mouth are the hadin ota atem oitim o pshara, but nonetheless the emphasis is, yes, you have a right to din, but I strongly advise you, or I strongly encourage you to agree to pshara. And this is really the sma, fleshes this out further in Shulchan Aruch, Hoshem Mishpat, Simen Yud Beis, says the sma, Hadina Temoitim or Pshara, Ayain Drisha, in his commentary in Drisha, Shilchak, if you mind the Kaimel on the mitzvah of Pshara, the Pask in the mitzvah of Pshara, Sokha Dayan, Lahasbil, the Baladim, Shara Noachlem. The Dayan is supposed to explain to Baladim that Pshara is better, Dabel Libam, and to try to really induce them to agree to Pshara, Laya, Schema, and Pshara. Okay, then maybe they'll try to agree to the Pshara, but not that the Pshara is not properly pushed. You have to mention the din, but you try very hard to get them to agree to the pshara. Now, it's interesting, I don't have this in the Maror Mekomo, so I neglected to include one source, and that's the source of Pishuris Rosh and Simeon Yudbeis, if, hey, the Machaber, the Shulchan Aruch, Paskin, basically like the Rosh, says as follows, Yesh l'dayin l'asot sadin kimo pshara. There are cases where even the din requires the dayin to paskin according to pshara. Well, even if you're just following din, you have to paskin according to pshara. What is that? If you're just relying upon the strict evidentiary rules of halacha, you would not be able to come to a clear-cut conclusion. So since, says the Rosh, a dayan really has no right to just say, right, I saw a comic strip like this once, right, where, you know, a judge listens to the arguments on one side, he listens to the judge's arguments on the other side, and comes time for him to hand down a decision, he says, hey, you know, the arguments on this side really have merit. On the other hand, the arguments on this side have merit as well. I declare it a tie. So says the Rosh, Dayan can't do that. You can't call it a tie. You have to issue some sort of decision. So if the strict evidence that has been presented doesn't enable you to be able to issue a decision based on din alone, then the Dayan has to decide based on pshara. Ve'en Rashi la'hoj see din chalok mitachas yada b'li gemar. He's not allowed to simply release the case from his responsibility without bringing a conclusion to the case. So sometimes even the din requires pshara. Further than that is the Yushami and Sanhedrin Perek Aleph that says that Dayanim really as a general proposition are strongly advised to refrain from deciding a case according to strict din. And that's the case where you have, one second. We just read it on the inside.
The bottom of page 10,
I have that. But with the Gra quotes the case that when Rabbi Yossi ben Chalapta had a case with two Bali Din that came in front of him, and they said, we want you to decide the case according to Din Torah. Amalei, ain't he yodea Din Torah? He says, I don't know Din Torah. Din Torah, that implies that I have a mastery over all of the details that the Torah, Kodesh Baruch Hu, has given us. we know that learning Gemara is a difficult exercise at times, and getting the din right, can be a very difficult exercise, and therefore it's presumptuous, even arrogant, of a dayan to say, I am the one who really knows the din. I'm the one who can figure out the din perfectly. If even in the days of Rabbi Yossi ben Chalafta, he felt that he wasn't right to decide a case as according to Din Torah, as it says the Shulchan Aruch, how much more so the Dayanim in our day, that we shouldn't be so presumptuous to say that we can decide according to Din Torah. So therefore, it's appropriate for Dayanim to refrain as much as possible, if a party comes to them for Din Torah, to say we really, you know, need to incorporate at the very least elements of Pshara. Now, how far does one extend Pshara? So here you have a little bit of a deal, and I gave you on the sources, I'll start to say a little bit on the outside, we have 15 minutes left. You have the Shvus Yaakov, who says that Pshara, who came up with this notion, it's offensive to many Dayanim. I find many Dayanim complaining to me about this. Everyone knows the Shvus Yaakov. Shvus Yaakov says Pshara means like up to a third. You know, you have the din, based on your best understanding of the din, would imply Reuven gets 100, so you make a pshara between Reuven and Shimon, so instead of getting 100, you can give him as little as 66 and two-thirds. You can make a pshara up to, you know, one-third less, or if Shimon is, only really entitled to 20, so you can give him, you know, what would it be, 26 and two-thirds, right? That you can give up to, you can change the judgment, up to one third, but you shouldn't stray more than one third. Dibre Malkiel says he doesn't think that it's so scientific. He thinks that I should back up a little bit. The Shus Yaakov is talking about Pshara Krova Ladin. Talking about, when I talk about Pshara, so I do, most people when they talk about Pshara, so the idea is that the Pshara should not be in a complete different universe from Din. So that's why, even if you look at the rules and procedures of the Beis Din of America, our rules and procedures say that we reserve the right to decide according to Din, but generally speaking, our default standard is going to be Pshara Krova Ladin. It's going to be some sort of law-based determination, which takes into account equitable considerations. The evidence isn't perfect, there aren't two kosher edim necessarily, but you take into account all of the circumstances of the case in making a decision. So Shvus Yaakov defines Pshara Krova Ladin as allowing for a variation of up to one-third. Dibre Malkiel says that as long as it's sort of on the other side of the football field, if I could use the football analogy, then you're okay. Meaning what? Meaning that, you know, to go from the goal line to the other side, to 49-yard line, so that's going too far. But if you're keeping it on the same side of the field up until the 50-yard line, so then you're all right. As long as you don't go more than 50% away from what the judgment ought to have been, if this promotes the best shalom, so that's basically within your rights. And he says it's even a din sort of basis for the whole notion of pshara, and that is that in classical halacha, in many cases where there's a tevia that's brought in front of a bet, the party has an obligation to take a shavua. And nowadays, because of the chomer of the issur shavua, the whole world shook when the mitzvah of not taking a shavua in vain was given. So we go to great lengths to avoid parties taking a shavua, but they should have to pay something for that. They're absolved from taking a shavua, so if a party would have otherwise had to take a shavua, they're absolved from taking a shavua, so it's considered appropriate, they should have to give up a certain amount of the judgment, maybe up to one third of the judgment for the dispensation that they didn't have to take a shavua. So he says there are many considerations to balance against that. If it's clear that the person would have wanted to take a shavua, just not letting them take a shavua, so maybe then you shouldn't penalize as much. Sometimes even pshara krova ladin, even though taking into account all the equities of the case, should mean that one party should get 100% and the other party should get 0%. We have cases in the Beis Din of America that even based on pshara krova ladin, there was no reason to change the balance of the award, that somebody got 100% of their claim and they got 0% of the claim. But you have to take all these considerations into account. Then he goes even further and he says that, you know, this is like already a little bit more lumdish. He says within pshara krova ladin, there's quantifiable damages in a case, and then there's qualitative. What's the word I'm looking for? I guess qualitative, or there's quantity and there's quality of an award. And sometimes you can adjust the quality of an award in a way where the effective quality of the award that the person's getting might be not so severely diminished, even though quantitatively it's being diminished more than 50%, and maybe that's also within the domain of Sharak Rovel Adin. So the upshot is that the once you get through with the Pisca, with the Dibbe Makiyot Shuvah, Chelek Beisim Kav Gimel, you come to the conclusion that there's a little bit more flexibility, shall we say, built into Sharak Rovel Adin. Sometimes, because of all of this tremendous flexibility, a party might say, hey, you know what, I don't want to subject myself to all these vagaries. And therefore, I am insisting that the Beis Din decide the case in accordance with pure din. So can the Beis Din insist, no, you're obligated on the halacha, just like Rabbi Black says, you can issue a seir, you can issue a contempt order against somebody for refusing to sign an arbitration agreement, you can issue a contempt order against somebody for refusing to sign an arbitration agreement that says I'm authorizing the Beis Din to decide the case both according to din and according to pshara. So here you have a disagreement between Poskim on this particular issue. I gave you in the materials an excerpt from the Piskei Din Rabbanim from Eretz Yisrael, Chelek Yud Aleph, I think it starts on page Reish Nun Tes, where there are three opinions. The third opinion is very, very long and esoteric, so I didn't copy it for you, but suffice to say that the third opinion was in agreement with the first opinion. I gave you the opinions of Rabbi Elazar Shapira and Rav Moshe Yosef Milsky, who were two dayanim on a three-dayan panel, that had to decide exactly this issue. One party, which was a corporation actually, refused to sign the business, refused to accept the authority of the Beis Din for pshara purposes. Says, I will only submit to these Beis Din for din purposes. So the question was, could a contempt order be issued against such an individual? So the majority of the Beis Din held yes, and that was the psak. And the argument of the majority, as expressed by Rabbi Elazar Shapira, is that the Yerushalmi, after all, says that even Rabbi Yosef and Chalapta felt he wasn't capable of deciding al pi din. So therefore, how can, you know, we feel that we're any more capable? We have to decide al pi pshara. And also, the Ramah brings a machlokas as to whether you can be kaifa on lifnim mishurat din, whether a Beis Din has the right to compel parties sometimes to decide lifnim mishurat din. He brings a machlokas, two different deos. The Bach and others say, well, the even though the Hachval, the Halacha, Bipashtis, is that we're not called to the Pnim Yishurat Adin, sometimes you really can be. And he says you can do it based on wealth considerations. It happens that our rules and procedures say that we don't make decisions based on wealth considerations. But it says based on wealth considerations, when we decide Sharak Rovel Adin, he says based on wealth considerations, one can sometimes be called on the Pnim Yishurat Adin. Therefore, it says the... it's an interesting tshuva. I don't know if I would have gotten to the same place based on the same argument. Rabbi Elazar Shapira says, so since we're dealing with a wealthy organization that doesn't want to accept Shara, but really they could be subject to being compelled to do the Shmim Mishurat Adin, which is really the same thing as Pshara, or in the same ballpark as Pshara, and therefore they're obligated to submit to Pshara, and they can be held to be misavrin if they're not submitting to Pshara. And says Rabbi Yosef Milsky, it's true that Rabbi Yosef and Chalapta refused to hear a case that the parties wouldn't agree to Pshara, but that's different from saying that the parties are compelled to agree to Pshara. You don't really find anyway. So you say, the Gemara says it's a mitzvah to encourage them to do Pshara. Look at the Sma. It's a mitzvah to encourage them to do Pshara, but that's not the same thing as compelling them to do Pshara. So therefore, you can't, you know, require them to sign a Shtar Birur. And I would say that one can make the argument that the whole argument is silly on some level, because even if you're agreeing to din, remember I just quoted to you that Sif from Shulchan Aruch, Simon Yud Beis, based on the Tshuvas Rosh, who says that there's sometimes the din requires that pshara be applied. So even if you're only agreeing to din, you're effectively agreeing to pshara in those circumstances where Beis Din is not going to otherwise be able to decide the case according to din anyway. Also, a Beis Din could argue, alternatively, that once we paskin in Shulchan Aruch, which is sort of, you know, a bottom line psak, that a Beis Din is obligated to refrain from deciding cases according to strict din because we're not really capable of it. So once we've already, you know, it'll come to that psak according to our, you know, halachic system, then parties, number one, can be compelled to agree to pshara because that's consistent with din. And number two, even if they don't agree, once they're agreeing to din, and din presumably incorporates at least the provisions of Shulchan Aruch at the very least, once they're in the Shulchan Aruch, says the dayanim shouldn't decide according to strict din, so therefore it's incorporated even within an acceptance of din. There was a case where this came up in the American Beis Din system, when the Beis Din of Beis Yosef issued a seiruv against somebody. I have the court case in the materials. This is a case... called, it's the very beginning of the packet, right? Ginsburg versus Goldberg. Nyman Ginsburg versus Goldberg, where the Bezdin issued a seiruv against somebody for refusing to submit to a Bezdin for pshara purposes. He was only willing to submit. It was a lawyer fee dispute. He was only willing to submit to the Bezdin for din purposes, and they brought a libel claim against the Bezdin of that Bezdin for issuing a seiruv, for issuing a contempt order, because he said this is defamation of character, said the plaintiff, because I was willing to submit to the Bezdin. I just said that I want it to be strict din and I don't want it to be pshara, and therefore I satisfy my Jewish law obligation. So he brought the same argument basically that was in front of the Bezdin Rabbani in Israel and the secular court, the Supreme Court in the state of New York back in 1998, basically paskins that the Bezdin was not culpable in this particular instance, not at all based on halakha considerations, but based on the fact that they were not equipped to decide any halakha considerations, because it's what we call an ecclesiastical question, it's a religious question, and the secular courts are not equipped to make a determination as to whether Eliezer Elazar Shapiro is correct or whether Moshe Yosef Milsky is correct. One could argue that maybe neither of them would have held in this particular case that he could be compelled to sign because it was an individual and not a corporation, but in any event, for the reasons that I gave, I think that a Bezdin could certainly make an argument that a party should be compelled just based on the fact that the Shulchan Aruch, which is in, says that Bezdin needs to be empowered to decide cases according to Pshara when appropriate. It's interesting, even Rav Elazar Shapiro says that when the party is compelled to say that a Bezdin has the authority to decide according to Pshara, that doesn't mean that the Bezdin necessarily can decide the case according to Pshara. They have to figure out if this is the case that falls within the parameters of when Pshara is is appropriate. But the our rules and procedures say the party, and this is the general practice of most Bati Din, that the Bezdin should be empowered to decide a case according to Pshara Klovel Din. It's a whole parsha to talk about the next topic, but we have 4 minutes, so why not? Orchei Din Mitoanim. I'll just talk a little faster. Don't worry, I won't. This is the last topic that I sort of put on, fourth to last, is Orchei Din Mitoanim, whether lawyers are ever appropriate to the Bezdin process. So I have an article about this, and I encourage you to read the article about Zkuyas Balim Toanim Orchei Din Miyayetzim. Basically, you're all familiar with the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, "Al tiyu ki orchei adayonim v'dimen tabai." It says the person should not be like lawyers. And this, what does that mean? Does that mean that we don't allow lawyers in our Bezdin proceedings? How far do we extend this this principle of we're not favorably inclined towards lawyers? So there are some like the Shiltei Gibarim that learn that this is really an asharas v'dayonim. The dayonim are not supposed to be the lawyers for the parties. Not supposed to act like lawyers and advise the parties what to say. But it seems like the more Kanam Shat, the Rambam and others seem to learn that no, it means that we frown upon the practice of lawyers essentially arguing cases in front of a Bezdin. The parties are supposed to speak for them for themselves. There are several cases in the Gemara in Ksuva. So the Gemara talks about the Choshev HaRav, a Choshev HaMorah, who gave advice to a family member that was involved in a dispute, who regretted it afterwards. A couple of cases he regretted afterwards, where he says originally he did it based on Sarkalot Salem, and afterwards regretted it because Adam Choshev Shaini, an important Torah personality, shouldn't engage himself in such a fashion. So the machlok is between the Bach and Tosfos Yontif, which is quoted in the Pesukei Tshuva in the Mekoros, where about whether if a person is not an Odom Choshev, whether that means that they're allowed to give advice with respect to a din Torah matter only to relatives, like the cases of Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Nachman, where they gave advice to relatives, or whether if you're not an Odom Choshev, you can give advice to anybody. And the Bach says, even if you're not an Odom Choshev, it's restricted to relatives, and that seems to be the majority of poskim seem to hold like the Bach. And Tosfos Yontif says, no, if you're not an Odom Choshev, you can give advice to anybody. But even then, that seems to be in the context of advice, but not in terms of the context of actually arguing a case directly in front of a Bezdin. That might be worse, because we have a principle of mipam, lo mipim, lo mipim, torgamon. They're supposed to hear from the Baalei Din themselves. in order for a dayan to really be able to decide a case correctly, he's supposed to hear from a baal din himself. So what's the justification that people use tohanim, shall we say, advocates or lawyers in bezin proceedings? There are really two justifications that are brought down. One justification is that we have a concept of harsha, that a person can assign their claims to somebody else. If a person has a debt to collect in a far-out place, the Mambava Kama and Dafayan says that you can assign somebody to collect the debt for you if it's difficult for you collect it yourself. They said that's only really pertinent if you give all the rights of the claim to this other person. Because a harsha means that this person becomes you. They become your representative. You sell the claim to them, whatever, you assign it, and they become you. But if you're able to kind of to take care of it yourself, you're not supposed to appoint somebody else. In fact, the Gemara in Shavuos, the Daf Lamed Aleph and Aleph, says on the Pasuk, Vashir lo tov asav esol chamav, that a person didn't act properly within their people, Rav Amar Zeh Bar Bershah. This is referring to somebody who came to Harshah, where they got involved in a dispute that wasn't theirs. It's not considered to be appropriate to get involved in a dispute that is not that is not yours. So the other justification is based on the principle that's brought down in Shulchan Aruch of Psach Picha Lilek. That a person is, that you're supposed to die in addition, has to kind of like balance. On the one hand, the principle of that you shouldn't act like lawyers, with the principle that if you have a party that comes before the dayanim, and it's clear that they might have a case to present, but they're just so inarticulate, that they have so much difficulty expressing themselves, that they're just not able to cohesively get out their words, so there's a mitzvah upon the dayanim to help to facilitate the parties to help them get the words out of their mouths. So based on Psach Picha Lilek, there could be some justification of having somebody to help the parties. Technically speaking, though, it's the job of the dayanim to help the parties. So I've argued in my piece that based on a Tshuva Sarashva, who hints at this, in my opinion, a hint at it. I mean, the Tshuva Sarashva was asked whether it's appropriate to bring a towing. So he says, of course not. He says, of course not. The parties have to speak for themselves. But he says, but if a party has difficulty expressing themselves, so then we say Psach Picha Lilek, and then he says even the Bezdin can argue on a person's behalf. So he seems to indicate that in such a case, even the Bezdin can argue on a person's behalf. A Bezdin can decide that in certain cases it's appropriate to bring somebody to help the person just articulate their claim. But that's one of the reasons why it may even make sense on some level that our practice, that we allow lawyers, but we don't, as the right, allow for rabbinic advocates, petonim, to present the cases in Bezdin, because number one, the decisions in order to be enforceable, according to American arbitration law, main shaltrim, main shaltim, require that you have to allow lawyers, but number two, the function of lawyers is also that what are they doing there in front of a Bezdin? They're not arguing halacha, they're not looking to make the halachic arguments for the parties or to involve themselves in what might be inappropriate behavior of arguing matters that the parties may have settled between themselves, arguing matters that, you know, that the parties that skewer the way that the events really occurred in order to gain a halakhic advantage on their party on behalf of one party, but they're simply helping the parties organize their presentation in a cohesive fashion, so that it will be a fulfillment of Psach Picha Lilek. So therefore, that's the more palatable to the Bezdin process, at least the way that we understand the way that the Bezdin process is supposed to be conducted. So in a nutshell, okay. So we have one more minute left. There was a little bit of a there are two different areas where there's a discussion about to what degree a Bezdin is supposed to kind of explain to the parties what they're doing. When a Bezdin sends a hazmana, does a Bezdin need to explain what they're being mazmin the parties about? So here you have a machlokas between the Shach and the Be'er Sheva, Sefer Be'er Sheva in the beginning of Simon, what is it? The beginning of Simon Yud Aleph, is it? I have to remember where it is. It's the Machlokes and Yud Aleph. I'm sorry, the beginning of Yud Aleph. The Shach is basically of the opinion. The Be'er Sheva says no. A Bezdin doesn't have to explain what the Tainus are. And the Be'er Sheva says, and the Shach says, of course, the Bezdin should explain what the Tainus are. Why should the Bezdin explain what the Tainus are? Because in the ideal universe, we want to make shalom between the parties. And it could be we don't need to have a din tov altogether. Maybe when the nitba will see what the claim is, the nitba will say, oh, sure, I agree with that, so I can, you know, reach a settlement with respect to this, and there won't need to be a din tov altogether, and therefore the shach advises to describe the claim. But Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva in Igros Moshe Chelek Beis Simen Vav Chelek Hoshe Mishpah, in which he is asked about the practice of appelling the Bezim of Buddhist of Abadim at the time, that they did not spell out the Tainus when they would send the Hazman. They would just say, Ruvain is summoning you, Shimon, to a din tov, it's about money. Something like that. They wouldn't explain exactly what the nature of the taina was, and he was asked whether this was considered to be proper. So he said that if you have a proper institutional bezdin, and the bezdin deems fit not to spell out the taina, it must be because the bezdin has come to the conclusion that it would not be of any benefit to spell out the taina, that if it could have been settled, then they would have tried to settle it sort of informally without sending Osman. If they deemed fit to send Osman, it's because they figured out it's not going to be settled all that easily, and therefore they're justified in not spelling out the taina. So therefore he justifies the practice, even according to the shach, of not sending out the taina. So over the years, I've come to the conclusion that because there's always a general criticism of the Bezdin process, of lacking transparency, of people not knowing what they're getting in for, that the more things can be out in the open and clear, just like for the same reason why we have published rules and procedures, it's better practice, we have concluded, to have claim letters spelling out the claims ahead of time. People know exactly what's being claimed. I have found on occasion that sending out the claim letter itself sometimes really does achieve the objective, even that the shach mentioned of having the party settle the claim even before it has to come to a din Torah, but it just enables there to be greater transparency, and especially in a case where you don't have a bezin kavua, where parties are not obligated to come to your bezin anyway, it gives a better feel that the bezin is at least sharing things with the party. So our practice that we've memorialized on our application form, which is not in the materials, but also you can find on the website, we say, please include 3 copies of the claim letter and supporting documentation. Describe the nature of the claim, including pertinent details, on a separately typed page. And please note that Bezdin of American policy is to forward copies of the claim letter and support documentation to all litigants. We put them on notice that we're going to share the claim letter, and we have just found that that is better policy. For the same reason, there's a discussion, and this is Zion on the list, and I'll leave Ches and Tessa for your own, you know, reading pleasure. But Zion on the list is whether the Bezdin is obligated to spell out the reasons for their psak. So the psak in Shulchan Aruch essentially is that Bezdin only really needs to spell out the reasons for its psak in 2 different scenarios. One, when they have compelled people to appear before the Bezdin. We generally don't compel, because our proceedings are voluntary in nature, that the people volunteer to come before a specific Bezdin. You could say, though, in a way, maybe it is compelled on some level if it's under threat of Siruf, so you can make the argument that it should be spelled out for that reason. Or number 2, the case is Makom Chashad, where it appears like suspicious, there's something about the Bezdin's reasoning where people feel, or the decision just doesn't sound right to the parties, and therefore they'd be suspicious of what's really going on here with the Bezdin. Are they just favoring one party for an arbitrary reason? So whenever there's a Makom Chashad, Bezdin should always spell out the reason. So the Pesach Shuvah already hints at the notion that nowadays it's always Makom Chashad. People are always suspicious about the din and the people and their motives and what's going on. So therefore, it's always appropriate to spell out the reason, so we try as much as possible. It's not an absolute rule, not among the Bezdin or in arbitration courts in general, but we try as much as possible to give a flavor, you know, of the reasoning of a psak when we give over the psak of the Bezdin. In one word, the description is laduna piumdina, whether circumstantial evidence can be relied upon. The Rambam indicates that it can, but says that you need a bezin of a particular stature, and the Pesach Shuvah indicates that when you have lots of circumstantial evidence to rely upon, and especially if you're deciding according to Pshara anyway, just like Pshara, you can decide when the din would not otherwise be able to be fleshed out otherwise. It seems that if you have strong circumstantial evidence, the maskana seems to be that something that could be relied upon. And bezin basa bezin lo daiki just means that once one bezin has decided a case, and the normal convention is that other batei din don't revisit the decisions of the first bezin. Whether things have changed nowadays, that the batei din are more suspect, and therefore other batei din can review their decisions. The Radvaz seems to indicate yes, the Beis Yosef and the Afkos Rocha disagrees with the Radvaz, Yibi Oymer, the Radvaz Yosef, talks about how if you have a structured system for Beis Din review, like a Beis Din Le'urim in Israel, might be a good idea. Our own practice in the Beis Din of America is that along the lines of Ravadi Yosef, is that we do allow for review by the Ar Beis Din or his delegate once the Beis Din has issued a decision. It can be appealed if the parties feel that there was a mistake in halacha in the decision that was handed down. It can be appealed to the Ar Beis Din. Okay, Atzah. Asher?
Mister?
Yes. Okay. Asher, you say, Mister? Or you look at yourself?